The one of my first teaching experiences right out of college in a Christian context was 2 and 3 year olds. So before my firstborn was even a conception in my mind as well as biologically, we were teaching 2 and 3 year olds. And I remember, and these were the kids of the faculty of a Bible college. So they came in, they were just generally already trimmed back, so to speak, right? But we opened up a bus ministry. And so they started bringing in other people that didn't grow up in that faith, so to speak. And I remember so distinctly the first experimental day where we tried this. In came this young, rather tall for a three-year-old guy, and he held back from the class. And we were in a basement. There were no windows in this where we were. He won't participate, you know, and so my job is to go try to warm him up and get him involved, right? And so I get up there, and he's leaned against the back of the door like this, and so I go lean, you know, and I look out over the little crowd that he's looking at, and I said, well, what do you think? Because he hadn't said anything so far. And he said, well, I think it's going to rain. And I realized that what he had done was just repeated something he had no doubt heard his father or mother or grandfather or grandmother say countless times, I think it's going to rain. So when he got put on the spot, to come, that, he fell back to the role model. And I remember just being blown away by that, just thinking about the power of that. That, as Bob pointed out, you know, you're a constant stream of education to anybody that's hanging out there, especially the little ones, because they soak it all up. And then they feed it back to you at adolescence. And as you know, and then what you are becomes very obvious when it's cast in your face, so to speak. So it's a very, very, we're going to get into some more of that today, actually, when we talk about the power of groups. So let's open in a word of prayer. Father, we do come to you. We are so thankful that you are our parent. That the more that we can spend around you and your word and seeing what you're doing in the lives of our fellows and our friends and our world, and our hearts, and what you did in the lives of the disciples and the apostles and men and women of God through the Bible, that we can learn and sponge off of you. We want to sponge off your heart of grace, character, beauty, and goodness and righteousness. We really want to do and be like you. So we would ask that today, as we would study the incredible work of your Son on the cross, that we would come away with a greater appreciation for the depths to which you would go in helping us, how far you would go in caring for your people, how much you would give because of your love and commitment. So we would ask that we would learn from this as we try to understand this as we look into this today. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Now, we have been we've been studying now for several weeks, I think. As an absent-minded professor, I forget how long I know it's been at least a week. I remember vaguely last week. We've been talking about something that's just normally pretty bizarre for Western world, you know, about the angelic powers and stuff like this. And practically speaking, you know, it's not as odd as one would think, because the rank and file of us, we normally are not aware of the stuff that governs us on the human realm either. The deals that are being cut at Washington and overseas and stuff, you know, we're not aware. We in today's world, we'll see about it on CNN or something like that, maybe. But we may not see it for 6 to 8 months, maybe, if then. In other words, we're not really that aware of what the powers that be are anyway. To us, They are now names and faces, but if we lived in the ancient world, we may not know that there's been a change of emperor. For example, you would typically have a change of Roman emperor, and some of the provinces wouldn't know for 9 months that's happened out there in the distance. And so we're more aware of at least who the players are, but because of pesky journalists, sometimes we know of what they do in these deals, you know. But generally, there's so much stuff that's kept from us, and it doesn't affect us a whole amount of much, it doesn't seem like. And so we have an analogy, but there's something further back than that we just don't see at all. And that in many cases, they wouldn't see either. And so we've been talking about this angelic realm of invisible powers. The world has always known about this. Like I say, and most of the world currently recognizes the existence of invisible spirits and that they do interact with the world. In the Western world, only parts of us have not, in the last, I'd say, 100, 200 years maybe, we've convinced ourselves that these things don't exist somehow. And that was probably a popular view up until about maybe 25 or 30 years ago. And then some academic things started changing in anthropology and psychiatry and things of this type that sort of opened our world up a little bit bigger, consciousness studies as well. So now we're back to we are not the biggest thing in the universe, and that there are powers out there that do have the ability somehow to interact with us. The three great monotheistic religions, however, by the way, have in their main deity, one of the jobs of that deity, so to speak, is to isolate us from those elements, to minimize the amount of contact that we have with these forces that are so much more powerful than us, so we can get on and try to build community as humans. The goal was for us to love one another, and we were supposed to be able just to deal as peers and organize things and live and things of this type, and that's a big enough problem as it is, without outside interference of a major level that we can't deal with. So there's been this, yes, that's a reality, but you're not supposed to go play out there. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to try to construct reality to where you don't have to, and I'll warn you not to, but you have freedom. If you go play in them, if you go mess around there, you bear some risk. And I'll try to put hedges. And so that reality, we've been looking at how the biblical position, the Judeo-Christian position, has understood the role of angels, they were called, and spirits, and demonic forces and things of this type in different languages. And we have seen that there were good ones, and then there were bad ones. There are those that sort of like us, and those that very definitely don't like us. The ones that don't like us have some level of authority over us, we have seen. And as Basil pointed out, they have the ability to judge us in a governmental, some kind of governmental capacity, and they don't wait very long before they want to do this. And they're accusers, and they have one of the powers that they have of judgment is deception. They can visit upon us what we do to one another. If I do something evil to you, in the sort of what goes around comes around model, I think somebody pointed out, they can do that back to me. If I deceive you in some kind of business deal, I can be deceived back. And the walls of mistrust and distrust within the community will grow, and we'll get more and more distant from one another. And community doesn't ever happen that way. You get further and further apart. In C.S. Lewis's sort of visualization of what one possible scenario of hell in the Great Divorce, he talks about how that people are completely free in hell to do what they want to, and they can move anywhere they want to. And so they go initially and they live next to somebody like them, they enter the communities. But then they get in some kind of squabble with them, and they say, well, I'll just go move further away since I can live anywhere I want to. And so they'll move away, and then they'll either move close to somebody else and they'll have a squabble there because they weren't for community up here. See, they didn't trust, they couldn't work together, up here or something like that, right? They didn't trust people, basics of faith. And so over time, these people have distributed all throughout this world, further and further away to where they live completely by themselves, totally isolated, right? But at least they're not having fights. They're only complaining about their neighbors that are millions of miles away. And it's an interesting scenario, because this is the divisiveness of what some of these angelic powers are represented as wanting to do in our life. Okay, and we went through the things that they did. Last week we actually talked about some of the mechanics of how the interface with the human mind works. And we didn't get into much detail about it, other than to sort of point out that it does happen. That now we see it. It changes electrostatic brain maps and things of this type. There are things that occur that are beyond our ability right now to scientifically explain. We can describe it, but we have no explanation from it apart from the existence of some alien intelligence that works. And the power of deception, I wanted to read a quote from a situation to show you how powerful this is in terms of an anti-God scenario. This is actually a quote from a New Age movement and the biblical worldview, in case some of you want to are interested in the history of the New Age and channeling and all that stuff here. But it's in an article that I wrote for The Tank. And I'm trying to describe, somebody wants to prove the existence of God by going and having one of these experiences, experiencing spirits firsthand. And I write, I'm trying to discourage them from doing this because it's generally a destructive, the history of descriptions of these is generally very negative, very negative. And I write, now this largely negative observation data from experience helps me understand better the biblical worldview. The biblical worldview, now this is me, I'll give you the quote in a minute. The biblical worldview admits the existence and operation of very malignant intelligences, all human-hating, community-hating, and God-hating. It describes these spirits as focused on deception, leading to various forms of influence and enslavement and destruction. They are known to disguise themselves as beneficent agents, New Age guides, Satan disguised as an angel of light, false teachers as super apostles, for purposes of deception. As spiritual beings, with the apparent ability to generate energy fields or local movements in energy, they can exert force on our spirits, on human spirits, giving rise to self-authenticating experiences that are false. Now, self-authenticating means when you have it, you're convinced that it's absolutely true. It authenticates itself. You don't even need a reason for believing it. It's just so obvious that it's true. Those are called self-authenticating experiences, right? A lot of our positions that we have inside relationships, of course, are based on those, where we know we're right. It's just, it should be obvious to anybody, but that's not the same level of severity as we're talking about here in most cases. In other words, openness to or invocation of or involuntary influence of these spirits could produce a powerful delusion that, quote, beyond a doubt, because I have felt it, dolphins are gods or aliens. If you think it's hard to validate the biblical worldview, try coming up with a method for adequately testing this worldview, friend. And that, now this is the quote from this book. The Dolphin Society Church trains persons in out-of-body traveling with dolphin and whale spiritual liberators. Jerry Doran of Wilmington, California. Okay. This is out of the book. I'm not, you know, singling this person out. Relates an out-of-body experience in which he encountered five blue-skinned dolphins floating inside a starship. The dolphins identified themselves as part of the stellar community of enlightened ecosystems, which is directing human evolution toward attainment of a, quote, group mind which includes the animals and plants of the earth itself, the sun, and similar enlightened star systems throughout the cosmos, close quote. Okay? Now, when you first read this, it's hard not to chuckle, right? It's hard not to chuckle. But then you think about the next comment. Let's assume just for the moment that the biblical message about God and Jesus and moral failure and the cross and death and final judgment are really, really true. I'm writing to a skeptic. Do you think that someone with a vivid experience like this Jerry Doran reports could ever believe something so ordinary or down to earth as the biblical message of simple honesty, faith, community focus, and love? After such a vivid and overpowering experience. Slim chance. Slim chance. Never happened. There's simply no way to guard oneself about being programmed against taking Jesus seriously, so effectively, as a malicious spirit. If one goes looking for some alternative alternative experience like that. Another quote. It can therefore be observed that these altered states of consciousness are either a passageway to reality or a passageway to delusion. But they are hardly a neutral phenomenon to which one can repeatedly subject oneself while retaining a detached scientific frame of mind. The impact on the psyche is too powerful, producing a subjective entanglement in the dynamics inherent in the experience. Although New Agers do not generally repudiate normal reasoning processes, they do believe that they have experienced something that transcends them. Thus, it is very difficult for rational arguments, such as arguments concerning the dangers of subjectivity, to penetrate their mindset. They simply assume that those challenging the experience have not had it. or else they would know. Right? See the danger there? I mean, you could just, once you've had something that vivid and that powerful, you know, how do you answer that? There's no way to come down from that into normal reasoning processes, normal to trusting a neighbor with a message so ordinary as the message of Jesus and the cross, quote unquote. Simple faith. So the dangers of being, once you get in there, you can get trapped and, you know, never get out, you know, apart from massive grace. Massive grace. So certainly, friend. Right. And that's a very common, and the focus often is upon the miraculous element in our claim, in the Christian claims. There's very common, I'll get on the think tank, I'll get comments about, well, it's only blind faith or things of this type. And it's sometimes worse than blind faith. It's deliberately choosing a negative thing. So it's very common that it's not, when you deal with the miraculous, you always have to deal with, one, did it occur, and what did it mean, which is a separate thing. And so very real. Like I say, that's one quote out of 80 pages where I'm having to deal with more of the skeptical issues. But very true. You'll get the same thing over on the Christian side, and then you have to ask, what is the basis for why I believe what I do? How self-critical am I in my thinking? Because that's one of the issues that God says, when Jesus is talking to the Samaritan woman, he says, those that worship him must worship in spirit and truth. And one of my personal experiences as a Christian for the second 25 years of my life was that he never lets me get away with just anesthesia about my beliefs. I'm being constantly called to question my faith, my beliefs, etc., by God, to sit there and say, now, why do you believe what you believe? Why do you fundamentally believe that Jesus rose from the dead? And it's like clockwork. Every 3 years it comes back up again, to sit there and call me consistently back to honesty, because, you know, the biblical view of God is that of truth, right? Not anesthesia. So you're always getting called to sit there and say, now look, because what we'll do is we'll turn dogmatic, right? We'll talk dogmatic that you're only baptized if you're sprinkled or immersed or whatever. You know, we'll focus, we'll take a minor and turn it into a major without thinking, okay, how much evidence do I have for this position? How strong is it? And therefore, how strong should I be about this? So we do have, same kind of issues that are raised against us, the Christians, and against all religious systems as well. So it's a good point. And it occurs constantly, Steve.
Right.
Yeah, there's so many ways of approaching that, but the fundamental you have to do is a historical one. And if you're going to look from the standpoint of evidence, you're going back to, you know, what do I have adequate grounds to believe when they said that they saw a risen Christ, you know, in group settings, eating with them and things of this type? You know, what evidence do I have that's something that outlandish? What reason do I have for believing? So, good point. I mean, good points all. The deception element, like I say, in the Judeo-Christian position is that you have to constantly keep asking the question. You have to constantly examine your heart, examine your faith. You have to constantly look at the standpoint of your honesty before God, because you will stand, just like everybody else at some level, before God, and your heart will be there on the witness stand. Your heart will be on the witness stand when I say, well, this is what I believe with all my heart, and then your heart says, oh, sorry, not quite. Remember that Tuesday back in 1965, you know, where we had this conversation, Glenn, and you say, well, I'm going to ignore the data this time. You know, the heart sits there, and so Paul always would come back and said, look, my conscience is clear. I got to believe this. And so the Christians are called to the same level of honesty that non-Christians are, or anybody are. It's all, we're called to the same level of honesty. And it's just that within most religious systems, there is an element that we have to watch for that's either deception from outside forces. But as we pointed out last week, the biggest problem is not them, it's us. It's our self-deception or deception of one another for various and sundry means. The piece I'm working on for the tank right now is on did we make up miracle claims? Did the New Testament authors make up miracle claims about Jesus to make him fit into Greek or Roman myth, or make him look like a Roman emperor, because they had people that would make up miracle claims about them. Augustus, for example, as a child, was famous for, as a child in the village where he grew up, he was being kept one night by the frogs, and he ordered the frogs as a little kid to be quiet. And a historian 250 years later says, and they haven't croaked to this day in that village. And it's interesting that this that the historical tradition, of course, was created by one of the people in Augustine's court that was financially dependent upon him. So there's a number of things at play that the church has not been innocent relative to either. So there are a number of issues there about deception. So now, what we're going to start on now on page 13 is we were talking last week. We ended up on possible places of interface and case data. And now what we're going to do is we're going to assume that that occurs on the basis of just what we've talked about, and then we're going to go into a sample, what I call a sample control program. If I'm an angelic force and I'm negative and I'm going to put a culture in bondage, these are the steps. This is one way to do it, one potential way to do it. And so I'm just going to take you through these quickly here. Like I say, I'm only human, and a bad one at that. And so I don't have the cleverness associated with this other realm. So, I mean, they may do it a different way. I'm just saying that we could sit here and think of one to do it now because people have done this. People have manipulated whole cultures this way. In smaller cultural settings, the divine kings of the ancient Near East would use a program like this, as well as, you know, modern smaller groups. So first there, I've got this on page 15, a sample control program. First, initiate a program of leadership usurpation. One, influence the current leadership to use personal pleasure as a measure of national policy. You know, it's what benefits me. That's what's going to decide. Good policy is what increases tax revenues and my power. Okay, that's apparently been a very successful global initiative. But it starts back at the story in the garden. When they saw that the fruit was good to eat, make one wise. You know, we'll just disobey community values and we'll put ourselves first. We'll do what we want to do and just disrupt the garden. So influencing the leadership to use personal pleasure as a measure for national policy. Then you exalt these values to the deprioritization of mercy and goodness. So all of a sudden, the most important thing is to put is to do things that make the king wealthy. Because in the value system, if you are one of the little underlings that helps the king in this way, right, guess who's going to get more money after a while? You're going to get promoted, right? So the value of said, that's more important than the king giving the money away to the poor or being beneficent as opposed to just soundbites, you know, where you do it and you get on the news as being this generous leader. But real commitment to mercy and goodness. So you exalt those values, you judge that sin, because that's wrong to do that. You judge that by giving them more blindness and enslavement to those lusts for power. Remember, because the angels are sitting here, every time that they, you know, you fall, that they do some kind of judgment on the human. Give them more blindness, increase the deception level by punishing lower levels with higher levels of delusion. So you make the subordinates constantly looking up to the management team, right? Management team gets more and more focused on conquest and power and prosperity, even to the point of starting to take lands from the poor during years of famine, things of this type. And then the subordinates, you also make them support that position anymore because, of course, there's a trickle-down of wealth in that system. Then finally, you use the delusion to smuggle in new values to guide public policy, like invade Assyria, war cry kinds of jingoism kind of things where it's a slogan that drives you. I remember very vividly, let me finish that sentence, especially divisive ones like war and conquest and economic power. Economic power is going to actually divide your existing community. Right. If you put all the priority upon wealth or power, anybody that doesn't have that gets marginalized. Right. By definition, my self-esteem, if I go check and see what it's like, the average median income in Silicon Valley. You take average median household income or something, right? And that changes every every year or so like that, you know. And if you were right around that edge and you checked it every year, see, in these settings you'd sit there and say, well, I should feel less about myself or I should feel better about myself, right? It would float with where you are, right? And so if you smuggled in the values to God that were around these that were divisive, anybody that didn't support the war effort or the conquest effort or the economic power effort would get marginalized, see? And they would lose their, and they'd be further divisive within that community, okay? So smuggling in new values to guide public policy, and that's at the leadership level. This is a role model thing. This is the role model. I'm changing the role models, the people that produce the literature that's fed in the schools, etc. Okay. Next, you go on to social transformation toward failure. You grow leadership according to the above. Okay, so you've got a leadership training program that's in this system, that people are recognized. Assyrian warlords are recognized for how well they support the Assyrian conquest of the leader. They're recognized. They're visually put in chariots and led around the town and things of this type. They're honored. This is how the system perpetuates itself, right? It's things that support the high leadership there. Then you use success and volume to get a hearing for bad values before the malleable. So if you take the middle of the bell curve, those of us that are, you know, we don't know whether that's right or wrong, not sure, haven't made up our minds, we're the not decided yet on the vote ballot, undecided, right? But we're going to vote, right? You use success of the power elite. You give them what they want. You portray their wealth, and so that me, that's, I could be swayed by this, I'd sit there and, well, that works. Well, they must be doing something right, because look at that. Gosh, what's the secret to success? Crush others. You know, whatever. You know, whatever they came up with a thing. It might not be that. Deceive, it could be any number of things, right? But you use that success or volume. You get enough people saying it in the culture, right? So it's consensus view, right? There are too many ways to do this. Good propagandists know this. Human propagandists know how to do this and have known how to do this for 4,000 years, right? No big deal. Perpetuate traditions and group pressures to discourage deviance from the norm. If the norm is bad, it's deviance from badness. So social pressure is so powerful, peer pressure. In the cultures that valued antiquity, the first objection against Christianity in the Roman Empire was that it was new. That's all. The big thing was that it was new. That was it. If it couldn't trace its roots to antiquity, it doesn't count. And the Christian apologists were scrambling to make sure that we were still understood as part of Judaism, so that we had a line all the way back to the back. And so that half the arguments were about, you know, how Jewish were we, you know, in terms of antiquity. But if it was new, it was bad. In our culture, it's sort of reverse. You know, now it's a measure of innovation, or it's not old fashioned, or medieval, or, you know, that's so 20th century, you know, those kind of things now, you know. And so you could use tradition arguments, that we don't do it this way, we do it a different way, to discourage social deviance, which in this case would be, I don't want to go to war, I don't want to bow down before the emperor, I don't want to sacrifice my land, you know, I don't want to disrupt my family experience, I don't want to worship these new gods or whatever, okay? Four, use God-given good feedback mechanisms of groups and communities to strengthen bad behavior. See, because the way the system is supposed to be set up is for good. We've studied this any number of times, that the way these dynamics work, they're supposed to be leveraged for good. That's the whole point of it, right? And but if I can sit there and take the warmth of community, and I can make people sign up on the basis of the strength of warmth of community for everything from Nazism to terrorism, you know, because there's belonging, there's a sense of commitment, a sense of ideology. I mean, I can take the things that were built for good and just put a different rudder, a different spin on it, and turn it bad. Okay? We see it around us all the time. But I'm just saying that in this particular case, it's the use of that it's like a virus. You take something healthy, the replication system of a cell, put something bad and say, well, I'm just going to run the ship myself, and you produce the negative things. Okay? And then anybody tries to escape this cycle, you can kill them or exile them, since death was an alternative punishment. Right? So at a level like that, you could transform a culture negatively. And we do know, in some ancient cultures, there were deliberate programs to do this on the part of just a human leader. Okay? To the extent the angels had control of external events, like weather, crops, or disasters, like the book of Job, then you do the providence thing and you support public statements in this way. So you'd have a court prophet that would get up there before the king of Sumer and would sit there and say, God's going to deliver your enemies into your hand. A lightning bolt would hit, wham, and it confirmed it. That's all it takes. Constantly, lightning bolts, you know, all these signs and, you know, things that were taken as divine signs. You know, and if they didn't get a sign out of heaven like that, they'd go cut an animal open and look at the entrails of the animal and read it. Remember, in around 3000 BC, we have a university an archaeological site of a college, a university, where there's something like 200 practice livers that students that were learning to tell the futures from the entrails of animals. The professor would reach into the box of livers and throw it out and say, okay, so what's going to happen tomorrow? This would be a test to his class. And all the livers had different kind of, you know, arrangements and things, and they would use that for training. So you could make a sign if you needed to, or you would interpret a sign of something like that. To the extent that if you were a real angelic power and you had the ability to do this, you could support public statements in this way. There have been a surprising number of major world decisions done on this basis. Especially the one in the Roman Empire that I've been studying just recently more. Develop soulless religion. This would be the next step. Is use that fear of death that we talked about to create religious rituals that open up the follower to more and more outside influence. Remember, you do religious rituals that when you would ask for more and more gods to get involved in your life, as we talked about. Okay? Use trances, mediums, possession, paid prophets, prayer to get the follower to invoke your activity as an angelic being in non-government areas of life, family and temperament. The way this was done often was with incantations. I brought one that's another, it'll look a little comical. You'll all know a sort of Christian version of this. But this is a chant, an incantation to calm a baby. Okay? So Babylonian parents sometimes tried magic words to calm fretting and crying babies. And I'll just read just a couple of lines. Little one who dwelt in the dark chamber, the womb, you really did come out here and you have seen the sunlight. Why are you crying? Why are you fretting? Why did you not cry in there? You have disturbed the household god. The bison monster is astir. You woke him up. Who disturbed me? Who startled me? He says. The little one disturbed you. The little one startled you. Like wine tipplers, like a barmaid's child, let sleep fall upon them. In other words, would you drug the kid for us, local household god? Right? And this was just common. I mean, the incantations in here are everything from snake bite against joint pain. That one doesn't work, I found out. That doesn't work. Everything from hiring a good assistant for HR. But what you would do, you would... But the point was is that you would open yourself more and more up to this, to these realities, and therefore you would keep that go. Keep the fear of death high by creating a host of impossible conditions and a steady stream of unexpected outcomes. Unpredictable God. Be the unpredictable God to keep them in contact with you. We read a long time ago an ancient prayer back quite some time ago that was quite moving because of the frustration, called the Prayer to Every God. It was in Ashurbanipal's library. I'm going to read part of it. May the fury of my Lord's heart be quieted toward me. May the God who is not known be quieted to me. May the goddess who is not known be quieted to me. May the God whom I know or do not know be quieted toward me. May the goddess whom I know or do not know be quieted toward me. May the heart of my God be quieted toward me. May the heart of my goddess be quieted toward me. In ignorance I have eaten that forbidden of my God. In ignorance I have set foot on that forbidden by my goddess. My goddess, O Lord, my transgressions are many, greater my many sins. The transgression which I have committed, indeed I do not know. The sin which I have done, indeed I do not know. The forbidden thing which I have eaten, indeed I do not know. The prohibited place on which I have set foot, indeed I do not know. The Lord in the anger of his heart looked at me. The God in the rage of his heart confronted me. When the goddess was angry with me, she made me become ill. The God whom I know or do not know has oppressed me. The goddess whom I know or do not know has placed suffering upon me. Although I am constantly looking for help, no one takes me by the hand. When I weep, they do not come to my side. I utter laments, but no one hears. I am troubled. I am overwhelmed. I cannot see. Man is dumb. He knows nothing. Mankind, everyone that exists, what does he know? Whether he is committing sin or doing good, he does not even know. Oh, my Lord, do not cast thy servant down. He is plunged into the waters of a swamp, taken by the hand. The sin which I have done, turn into goodness. The transgression which I have committed, let the wind carry away. My many misdeeds strip off like a garment. And the point was is that lacking, as the writer says, lacking information concerning the kind of conduct required by the gods, the people found themselves depending on their circumstances in life to determine their status with the deity. You had to figure, if something bad was happening to me, then something I did something wrong. You'd try to find out what it was, you know, so one, you could stop it and not do it again. But when you didn't know, you had to call on all the gods. Some of the things list 100 deities that they ask. Whoever it is that's picking on me, please, help, or leave me alone, or whatever. And so you're constantly opening yourself up to wider and wider areas. And so you keep the fear of death high by creating a host of impossible conditions and unexpected. You didn't know what was going to happen. Make sure the religious rules focus them on manipulation and perhaps social benefits so that the heart never got involved except in pride, bigotry, or elitism. In other words, as long as if you can turn it magic to where I manipulate God, see, my heart's not going to get involved as much. You know, it's just something I do. It's a technology usage. You know, I can get frustrated, but I wouldn't have intimacy with this God. And it would be what I call, for lack of a better term, soulless religion. It would just be something to in the Roman situation, they really didn't believe in these gods. They honored them because they would pick on them. And every time something bad happened, they'd sit there and say, who have I messed up with now? They'd go to an oracle, and the oracle would say, what you didn't do is you need to send 4 oxen over here to Bithynia. You needed 4 sheep over here in Macedonia. You forgot about, you know, the people weren't sincere enough in their worship over here in Alexandria. And so the oracles would tell you, and then you go fix that, but then the problem's solved, you know. And it's just it's a difficult situation, and one that was very frustrating for the ancients. It bred a lot of cynicism and skepticism among the people that had to work in that, and it's constantly in their writings. So this was just a sample control program. And then we go to point 16. That was just, like I say, just if you look at that, a lot of those things already happen in our culture. I mean, we don't see the powers behind them, but we can see the influence of some new movement or some new fad or fashion that changes the way we look at things. He was trying to document some of those fads. When he gets into the early part, he talks about the vagueness factor, that the fact that real life was the first one. In the first, he talks about how real life always convinced people to not think about God, and that every time they started to think about the bigger pictures, that the devil in this place would give them a taste of real life. And his example was that would mean they'd go to the bus stop, and they would smell the streets, the smells on the street. They would see the noise and the clamor, and somehow this was real life that convinced them to no longer think about this issue, their relationship with God. So there were elements like that, but there were a lot of machinations about how you would influence the cultists toward magic and excessive belief in miracles, irresponsible beliefs in miracles. Okay, we have plenty of this within Christendom, irresponsible belief in this, uncritical stuff. Or toward a radically materialist world, right, where, you know, I deny the existence of the human mind, per se. So, yeah, he discusses those later in the works about changing, trying to move the culture as well. Good question. Okay, so 16, that was just a sample there. 16, these angelic authorities have so influenced human leadership groups over time that even the existing human institutions can and do reflect in differing degrees their angelic agenda. The scriptures use the phrase, the world which lies in the hands of the evil one. The whole world lies in the hands of the evil one, who is also known as the ruler of this world, could continue along an anti-God path even without angelic empowerment, direction, and innovation. In other words, if everything got shut down, all the angelic forces got shut down today, okay, some of our institutions would continue being bad. It wouldn't get better, necessarily. Okay, it just would go on status quo, perhaps, or some level of degeneration, just normal. Without some kind of direction or innovation, it might not change radically. It could be steered in positive directions in that situation, by the way, by good influence. Good influences and agents, of course. For example, a new precedent could be set by servant leadership or teamwork. You had a fresh organization that had was just working on its own power. You got a good leader in there. You get your role model benefits and some teamwork thing, and the whole culture moves. We know this works in corporate culture now, okay, in today's world. But there would still be corporate culture resistance to the intended improvements. That's called change management. I did literally a whole day training in Australia back last spring on change management, which only has to do with once you've got the right project in mind as a corporate executive, how do you just keep the natural resistance of people from derailing? Okay, their whole strategy, it's a whole discipline called change management just to stop people from derailing something that's good. Okay, I also taught them how to derail stuff that was bad. That was very Machiavellian, but that's a separate thing. But the lectures are out on the web if you're interested in the video of how to, for free out there, on how to derail change, right? Lovers of God face three enemies: the sinful aspects of ourselves, that's by far and away our biggest problem, two, the world, organized systems, and the devil. Any one of these is sufficient to derail our best self-funded efforts at righteousness in life. Any one of those can clobber you if you're just going to try to do it on your own, right? We admit the enemy and they is us. Individuals have the power to turn internal will decisions into actions. We can make a decision, turn it into an action. We can turn that into a habit. And over time, we can turn that into our character. When these individuals are part of a group, their actions, habits, and characters can become group influences, right? Models and values. Organizations have a life of their own, analogous to individual choice consequences. I've got a little table there where I compare things that we do as individuals to what happens in organizational life. So, for example, in individuals, we get our input from our senses, from our imagination, from role models and things of this type. Groups get their input from the environment, from internal planning sessions, and from the models that they're taught, like in B school, who's the best, most aggressive in entrepreneurial company, who's got the best portfolio of risk management. Those are held up as models to us as organizations. Individuals have thoughts. Groups have pools of ideas and values. There's an analogy. There's a reason that they're called corporations, their bodies, because they do sort of have a life that mirrors our life. Individuals make decisions and choices. Groups have dominant voices. They build consensus. They have what's called management will. Individuals have words. Groups, of course, have policy, statements of direction, mission statements. It just maps right across, right? Actions. Individuals have actions. Groups have operations and initiatives. We have habits. Groups have policy, procedures, standard operating procedures, precedents. These are things that you default. When you hit the enter key, this is what you get, right? You just take the default. Individuals have character, values. Groups have implicit values, priorities, exception processing that identifies where the values are. So there's a good map in terms of how organizations live in terms of individuals. And then remember the metaphor of group learning. Now, this is one of the more comical things that I've run across in years, but boy, is it true. Start with a cage containing five apes. In the cage, hang a banana on a string and put stairs under it. Before long, an ape will go to the stairs and start to climb toward the banana to get the banana. When he gets halfway up the stairs, spray all of the apes with freezing cold water. Okay? That's called negative reinforcement for those of you. Okay? After a while, another ape makes an attempt with the same result. All the apes are sprayed with cold water. Do this for 5 repetitions. Turn off the cold water. 5 minutes, okay. Turn off the cold water. If later another ape tries to climb the stairs, the other apes will try to prevent it, even though no water spray is on. Because right? They know what's about to happen, right? Stop him at step 1, because if he gets to 3, we're going to be freezing for a couple hours till the water drops. Right? Now, remove one ape from the cage and replace it with a new one. The new ape sees the banana and wants to climb the stairs. To his horror, all of the other apes attack him. After another attempt and attack, he knows that if he tries to climb the stairs, he will be assaulted. Next, remove another of the original 5 apes and replace it with a new one. The newcomer goes to the stairs and is attacked. The previous newcomer takes part in the punishment with enthusiasm. It's learned behavior. It's group learned behavior. Again, replace the 3rd ape with a new one. The new one makes it to the stairs and is attacked as well. 2 of the 4 apes, though, that beat this one have no idea why they were not permitted to climb the stairs or why they are participating in the beating of the newest ape. They don't know, right? After replacing the 4th and 5th original apes, all the apes which have been sprayed with cold water have been replaced. Nevertheless, no ape ever again approaches the stairs. Why not? Because that's the way it's always been done around here. Right. Now, when you get at the end of this, you think, now, where is the evil in this? I mean, there's nothing demonic or spiritual about this. There's nothing particularly clever about this. It's the way organizational life and groups can take on a life of their own, for good or ill. So you can program for good, program for valor, for mercy, for compassion, to where the default is, let's help them up the stairs. I think about the difference in competitive attitudes. There was a joke that I used to use all the time in speaking to business audiences about being ahead of your competitors was. And it's about these 2 backpackers that are going across Africa. They're hiking across Africa. And they come around one of the hills in the plains, and about 50 yards out they see a lion that sees them at the same time. The lion makes the appropriate salivatory indications that he sees them, starts charging them, whereupon one of the hikers sits down, unpacks his bag, starts taking out his running shoes to put on his running shoes. Starts putting on his running shoes. The other one has an appropriate response and freaks, loses it. Says, my goodness, man, come on, let's go. What are you doing? I can't believe you think. What are you putting your running shoes up? There's no way, even with your shoes, that you're going to be able to outrun that lion, man. And the guy down the ground putting on the shoes says, well, you don't understand the problem. I don't have to outrun the lion. I only have to outrun you. Right. Now, that's a very crass, very violent metaphor, but it's somehow competition is seen. Let me contrast that with the Special Olympics a couple of years back. Four 40-yard dash, you have these individuals out there on the individual lanes. They're starting around. They get halfway across the track. One of these individuals trips and falls in the middle of the lane. All the other people stop, come over, help him up, and then they restart the race from there. Now, that's the difference of a value system that you can hit default key and hit. See, there are positive ways of doing this, but it takes more childlike spirits. It takes more trust of other people, a fair notion, a fairness in what we're all about, right? So, because the way it's always been done, you can program an organization to make the wrong move. And then the final point under this rule is that social and cultural organizations in their design and logic do not seem to be evil per se, but the instances and the implementation of those in the fallen world seem to reflect the fallenness of that world. The structures of our existence to a large extent represent the composite result of human ideas, affections, and activity. Both evil and their ideas have an evil beginning, and therefore we spoil the fruit. We are the problem, right? We can change it. I mean, we can make a huge difference. We'll talk about this probably next week. And we'll have to, because I want to spend more time a little bit on the social element so that we can see some of, because see, all I'm painting is the problem that leads up to the cross. I haven't got into common grace, all the stuff that God's doing in our life, all the positive things that are at work to counteract this. And then when we get to actually the definitive result on the cross, that sets a new level of freedom up that changes it from an unfair fight in this direction to an unfair fight in this direction. A wonderful, chance of knowing truth, but we have to be consistently self-critical. The Holy Spirit constantly brings us back. And his point was quite well taken, that you've got to always keep coming back to this, because we've got to make sure that we're not self-deceiving, being deceived by the group that we're in, or less in the case of a Christian context, by some outside power. But these are very, very real concerns that the organizations that we're in, they're not evil themselves, but they're evil because we're in them. I better stop now. We'll go another hour. So we'll do that next week if we get a chance to. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for your love. We thank you for your goodness. We thank you for your care. We thank you that you are a God of truth, that you do call us, and that these things that we are not equipped to deal with, that you have provided a way for us to be free from them. And that we can deal with the challenges of our own heart and our own world and keep us safe. We thank you so much for your commitment to us and your love and the demonstration of that love on the cross, the unambiguous statement of the death of your Son as an expression of your heart, your commitment. And that as Peter said, that we did not follow myths and cunningly devised fables, but we were eyewitnesses of the glory of the Son of God. And we could never thank you enough for revealing that, putting a truth base right in the middle of history for us, so that you do call us to honesty, you do call us to this. Help us as we go into our organizations, we look at our world, that we would see it as changeable and see that, but if we don't get in there and mix it up, nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to happen, even in the short term. And bring us back to safely together next week, Lord, to look a little bit further about these social dynamics and what our role as Christians might be in some of these settings as well. We thank you for the forgiveness of sins. We thank you for the assurance of your involvement in our lives. Thank you for your Son, the Lord Jesus Christ.